Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. My very special guest joining me today, and you know, it's sort of like a generalised thing. Everybody's a very special guest, and what was it somebody said the other day, as if, you know, they call people who are retarded special. So if you're very special, it means you're extra retarded. No, it's not the case. My very special guest, nonetheless, is Cliff High from halfpasthuman.com. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thanks much. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you back because I think I've been asked maybe three times since our last interview years and years ago, which was the most, you know, standout interview that I've ever had. And it was always you. Always, you know, I interview like 4 or 5 people a week, and still nobody's able to top you. So that's a good endorsement.
Yeah, probably most of them aren't bald. It really makes a difference.
It does. And I'd like to know exactly what you've been up to these last couple of years, or basically talk about whatever you're passionate about. But first of all, for those who are uninitiated, could you please explain to them who you are and what it is you do?
Well, I run a software program that I devised in the 90s around a concept that I invented called predictive linguistics. And this software basically predicts the future to some degree better than chance, how much is debatable in any given time period. And I've been running it since the early 2000s. I've had some notable hits with it. People buy it. They use it to predict future or to guide their actions in an uncertain future. And it's based on the idea of the all humans are psychic. Whether we're aware of it or not, we leak this psychicness out, these prescient perceptions in our language changes. It's relatively easy to understand. The concept is basically that we have a very narrow vocabulary that we use in any given week. Even though we may know 100,000 words, we're probably not likely to, you know, in any given week, bumbling through our workday, that kind of thing, give me a coffee, you know. Basically, it's all the same language week to week to week. And so what I tumbled 2 years ago was the concept that, oh, well, frequently we'll really reach outside of our normal lexicon and come up with an unusual word for this, basically the same subject. And I wondered why that was. And that's, I think, is really the perceptions leaking out in our changes in language. And so I typecast all the language, and I make forecasts off of these leaks that people use in their everyday discussions. So I have software that goes on out and does things like read garden forums and then bring back information that's basically different from the last time they were at that garden forum. And then we pour through it, throw out most of it, and look for these little prescient leaks that come on out. Sort of makes sense.
Is it all completely automatic, or do you have to manually run through the data and siphon it out?
Well, it's I'm a lazy butt. Okay, yes, there's about 200 plus programs. I don't actually have to go through the data to throw out stuff, because that's automated. There's about 200 plus executables that are run. I've consolidated some. It's one of these things as a software engineer. You get into a particular train of thought or a particular endeavor, and by the time you get close to the middle of it, you realize all the mistakes you initially made at the beginning, but it's too late to go back and change them. You're stuck with them in the code, and you've got to continue on because you must reach the end. Again, if that sort of makes sense. And so you get to the end, and the code at the end of the project may be very eloquent and elegant in a computer sense. Eloquent in being small codes and elegant in the sense of being complete and correct in achieving its task. And you look at the code at the end of the project, and it could all be done by the same mind, and you go back and look at the code at the beginning, and you say, huh? What happened here? And what happened is you become educated to the task as you go along. Now, my task in as a computer software engineer frequently involved what's known as software design expressions. And a design expression can be thought of as like a joint in woodworking, okay? So you're a carpenter. Someone gives you the task of constructing a chest of drawers, 100 with 100 drawers in it. And each drawer has 4 sides. It's real simple, but it's going to require 10 dovetails on each side. You got four sides. You got 40 dovetails per drawer times your number of drawers, and it goes on, and you think, aha, if I'm going to do that, I'd better make myself a jig. and that's what a design pattern is. It's sort of a jig for software engineers, because the pattern allows them to solve problems that are common within the expression that you're attempting to reach ahead of time. Again, if that makes any sense, it's like knowing that you're going to need that dovetail, so you know how to do dovetails really well. And
that sounds similar to my video editing process, where I have basic set templates to keep audio synced up and everything. And if I mess up or even take a fraction of a second out in the start of the video, it throws the rest of it all out, and I have to basically start from scratch. Otherwise, everything looks like crap on it. Is that sort of it?
No, not quite. It's sort of the reverse of that. As a software engineer, my task would be to come into large coding projects and look at them in the first third or half and discover the problems that they were continually solving over and over and over again in difference in scale. So basically, you can think that it's an issue of scale. You'll solve the same problem with a particular kind of a loop here, you'll run into this another expression at a different range or software engineering is just I mean, it's terrible trying to explain this stuff.
Oh, dude, don't worry.
Okay, but basically what I did was to hunt for those patterns that could be reused over and over and over again within code whenever you ran into these kind of problems. And it in a sense, it led me to thinking about language and the very nature of language, communication, why people do things within language the way they do. And so I shifted out of, I started off as a coder, went into debugging, went into software design, and then into consulting and the engineering, and then gradually shifted over into linguistics as I started applying these same concepts to the analog computer that we have that we call life. And I started looking for these same kind of patterns, and lo and behold, they actually exist. And within that framework, I could take those patterns and apply them to words. So, for instance, I know that slang has a very short lifespan. Slang that survives outside of that lifespan contains something within it that may last that particular age group, that cohort, their whole generation, and expresses a, in my opinion, a quantifiable emotional context that you can capture when that word is used in certain other physical or certain other contexts. And so I would know, for instance, that some slang is going to survive for a while, and it has a particular meaning to particular generations. It can be used to identify those generations, because when other generations use slang, they sound funny and they misuse it. It has a tendency to be used within a grammar that is not cohesive around the slang itself, because slang comes not just as a word, but within a grammar itself, like she jacked my ride, as opposed to, my ex-wife had my car repossessed, or the bailiffs came and took my vehicle because of the judgment against me by my former wife. Each of those basically expressing the same concept in three different levels of thinking about it. One very visceral, very emotional, short-term, high emotional, short duration. Another in the medium range, and then another in the long range. Make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like a translator to a degree. It's taking all the different things that people say and then translating them so it can actually interpret that they're saying the same thing.
And actually, here's what we're looking for, okay? So you're likely to use what I call long-term language if you have had a legal disturbance in your life. So you're sitting there, you're doing your work, someone comes along and gives you a summons. There's a certain gut response that you get to this that thereafter, for a period of time, you'll use a what we call long-term value language. And it has to do with all the legal language you've been reading as a result of the summons and the fear you've got and all the other issues. And that fear really makes that language very intense. It gives it a very long duration. The intensity is at a slow boiling all the way up until it reaches a quick boil. It has all of these various parameters. The result of that, though, is that all through that week, all through the next week, and the week after, you're likely to find that the language you would use in a normal ordering your coffee, going out to dinner, any of these things will change, and you'll be talking about a different range of subjects and so on as you go forward. Now, this would be expected if you'd received the summons. What is unexpected is when that same shift occurs in your language without that initial prompt. And so you're going along, you get long-term language, long-term values starting to creep into your language. You shift away from slang into slightly more formal grammar and syntax. And then a week or so after that happens to you, all of a sudden you get a parking ticket in the mail or one of those nasty grams from your local municipality saying their computer thinks you ran that red light and you owe them money. And so what was actually happening was you were making that transition in your language ahead of that event occurring. Again, sort of makes sense?
So it's sort of like you latent psychic abilities coming through, and you've developed a program that can actually harness it and sort of interpret it?
The interpretation is more human-oriented. The rest of it, data gathering, the data sifting, vast quantities of that, some pre-processing and comparing this week's data at this time in this form against last week's data at this time in that form, et cetera, that kind of thing is automated. And then it comes down to a level of interpretation where I sit here and I look at vast quantities of little dots that are thrown up in this display I devised. At the time that I got into this initially, the internet was, this was in 1993, and the internet was just growing. It was primarily English. It represented mostly computer professionals, so the initial work was relatively easy. And then it started growing, and everybody started getting in, and different languages and cultures, it started expanding, and it got to be a huge mess. And all my software, getting back to the original thing, was all my software code just sort of grew, and I'd quickly have to write a patch here when I came across the same kind of an expression showing up in a forum that had just appeared that had millions of Hindus in it, and I had to capture that language in Sanskrit, Pali, and all of the various variants, and then translate it because it was very meaningful. So, because some cultures are actually more prescient than others. Language is really interesting, for instance. Mostly in the Anglo-European cultures, likely as a result of religious domination, we have a tendency to concentrate on negative expressions, and we are less likely to express ourselves positively or emotively in an outward loving sort of a response. We're more much more inclined to, as I say, concentrate towards the negative side, and that's not true in all cultures. The Chinese and the Maine are very pragmatic and middle of the road, as you may expect. Some of the more tropical cultures, including all the way down into Brazil, are much more positive, much more upbeat. Their language is probably runs 16% more positive words in any given description of the same kind of event, positive or negative, than the corresponding description in English. So it's a cultural proclivity that you have to look at and engineer in. Some of this stuff can be engineered in, others has to be chosen out by the human.
Well, I would think that the tropical cultures wouldn't have quite so much negativity in their language, because they don't go out when it's like 30 below and go, Jesus, it's cold!
Yeah, and they don't have to wear those funny suits to go out when it's 30 below. Yeah, exactly, yeah. No, and you know, it's a different... it varies in terms of the expression that the humans have within the cultural context. So not all tropical cultures express the same way, but I've noted that except for what can be called Oceania, Pacific range of you know, the islands from actually your area all the way up through to British Columbia, excepting that area, we've had a general shift towards the Anglo-European negative expression thing over these last probably 12 years that was not initially noticed by, at least by my software, and in the late 90s. Now, I have to do this frequently. I have to, because language changes so constantly, I've always got to keep an eye on what's going on within my software relative to what's going on within the cultural expressions themselves. So you can't hard code in their slang expressions or any of that. You've got to have a dynamic active database that you're constantly tuning and populating to, and this is what I call the lexicon, in order to maintain, I guess, referential integrity with the cultural culture around you when you're pulling all this data in. And so slang comes into existence and drops out. It's actually a real pain. The dealing with slang in any language is just a huge amount of effort in this. It's very, very, very worthwhile, though.
Going to have to just stop you there. Hold that thought. We'll be back from the break in just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a listener-supported broadcast, so please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate today. My guest today is Cliff Heyer. Now, Cliff, I'm sorry, we got cut off by the break just before there. Do you remember what you were saying?
I was discussing the nature of tuning the lexicon, basically, and how slang is a very difficult thing to track because it rises and falls very rapidly. And it's actually isolated to a very narrow generation, so it's easy to find sites where you can pick up on slang as a radical linguist, which is how I term myself now. And you can pick this up because of the age group you're after. For instance, anybody over 29 is not out inventing new words, with some exceptions, cultural exceptions. But in general, the slang is kept between, say, 5-year-olds to, say, 16. And it actually ranges off into the mid-20s, but it's not a creative range beyond 16. You see the messing about with words in your head to create new meaning and context fades after that, because probably because you're more involved with the opposite sex and you're not using your brain that way anymore. But in any event, slang is very prescient, and it actually would go to the idea of, you know, the prepubescent humans having more psychic ability, which is, you see in Hollywood movies all the time. You know, it's always the poltergeist is always controlled by the prepubescent child in the area, or something along those lines.
Until such a time as their pineal gland is calcified from the fluoride they're drinking.
There you go, exactly. Or you know, is shut down by the electromagnetic radiation from the Wi-Fi that they sleep next to, sort of things. However, slang is a very it's like striking the mother lode, because sometimes you get a lot of prescient ability out of the slang for very little data mining.
What about text abbreviations like LOL and ROFL and all of that kind of stuff? Because I've noticed a trend in language just over my short lifespan is that everything seems to be getting shorter and abbreviated at an alarming rate. For example, in the 1930s, if you were to say hello to somebody, it would be good afternoon, good sir, how goes your family, how goes the morrow? And over time, that's been shortened to sup.
Yeah, exactly. That's also part of the, it's a natural trend, though, that you can look at from any number of points of perspective. As a computer programmer, I deal with it all the time, because you're always dealing with the abbreviations that are within the code. That's why they call it a code and not really a language, but they're all programming languages. But you write code within the language. So it's a natural expression of the technology, which speeds up the interaction of our senses with the outside world. So you can look at it, I think that's probably the most overarching and grasping way to look at the concept, and that would be to say that the exposure that we've had to television is such that it alters your mind tremendously, and beyond television to all the forms of media. So imagine the fellows in the 30s, where their largest contact with media consisted of telephones, and that is interactive media, and not the passive media of the cinema, where basically it was just a storyteller flashing images in front of their brain. But we started getting into interactive media with pre-programmed commercials and all of this sort of thing within television in the 40s and late 40s and early 50s, and it's been accelerating ever since. Now, that has a tendency to cram in sensory input. So here's the concept. The man in the 30s might be exposed to visual images if he was in his in 1930, if a man was 30, he might be have been exposed to, say, 45 or 50 murders in a year and a half within the media that he looked at, and in a passive fashion. Yet, if you're a gamer today, these days, even as young as in your pre-teens, you might be exposed to active participation in murder, defense, flight and fight kind of reaction within the gaming, which is real to your body and to your senses at that point. And you might see 100 murders a day if you keep getting killed or if you keep killing a lot of people, right, within the concept of that game. And so the level of expression has been hugely compressed into our minds and everything, and the only way that we can cope with that is to shift and get rid of everything that we think is extraneous and slice it all down to the very essentials, which is why we kind of find ourselves in a, in many cases, in a servitude relationship to the technology, where our not as thinking beings per se, although there is some of that. You're a slave to answering the phone when it rings. You know, you haul it out of your pocket and answer it, or in some way look at it, respond to the text, and so on. So you are a certain slave to it that way, but you're also a slave at the sensory input level. Now, bear in mind, you only have four senses. Most of the planet thinks you have five, and most of the planet, as usual, is wrong. And the four senses we have all are organized as subsystems to our bodies. And these four senses are all involved with sensory organs, and they're all from the neck up. Now, what we think of as touch has no sense organ. There's not a sense organ for the perception of touch, as there is in the sense of eyes. So we do not feel light coming into our eyes. We don't react with that light. Most people don't have any sense of feeling at all from their eyes, except for extreme pain when the structure around the eye has been altered. And the eye is, in essence, in all respects, it's a subsystem to your computer program that just delivers you an output without you being aware of how that output was achieved. The same thing is true of your sense of smell, your sense of taste, and your sense of hearing. Now, these senses, these natural components of your body, can be assaulted and are assaulted in many ways by our modern way of living. And in doing so, in reacting to our senses, our sensory body-mind has to take certain defensive actions. And one of those defensive actions is, as you've noted, the compression of context into a smaller time slice, and the delivery of it being as direct and as immediate an expression of that time slice as is possible.
Is one of the side effects of that people having a 30-second frickin' attention span?
That I think, no, actually I think not, okay, because you have, I think that's a directly engineered effect that it was sought. It doesn't affect everybody. It's not ubiquitous. It affects a certain a subsegment of the human population, a certain subset. A lot of the expressions I'll use, by the way, relate to set theory, because my whole program is organized around the set theory within set logic.
Could you quickly expand on what set theory is?
Set theory is the idea of you collectively in your brain you organize things into groups that are called sets. So, for instance, apples and oranges are each in different sets. They come from different trees, but they're in the same set because they're both fruit. They're in the same set with tomatoes because tomatoes come from are also a fruit. But tomatoes are in its own set because it doesn't come from trees. Make sense?
Categorizing, chronicling, sorting stuff. This is how we make sense of the world.
Correct. Exactly. So that our minds work in that sense of collectivizing and aggregating and slicing and dicing. And so I just followed that metaphor within the software to take advantage of a capture again of the analog way in which our minds think in reality. So getting back to this idea that there's a certain subset of the populace that's being manipulated more extensively than any other subset of the populace. We can categorize this set of the populace, but it's now becoming harder and harder to do so because the political correctness movement is verging on a religion. And you don't want to have these politically correct constraints on your language if you're actually thinking about reality in a meaningful sense. And they do attempt to constrain our language because they want to constrain our thought and our expressions of the thought. So, for instance, you could say, for instance, that retarded people are prone to being gullible. You could say that people with Down syndrome can be considered to be in the same set as retarded people. But these are not politically correct statements, especially when applied to individuals. And that's what they do, is they say, you can't call that individual somebody suffering from Down syndrome, nor can you call them in any way retarded. Retarded simply means not as fast. It doesn't mean anything beyond that. And yet it has become associated, just like you can't use words like prejudice or discriminate. Discriminate constantly. Go ahead.
A friend of mine actually, funnily enough, sent me a meme to this effect. It says, political correctness is nothing less than thought control. Step one, cause people to worry about offending those around them. Step two, once afraid to speak out, then afraid to think it. Step three, once afraid to think it, it is never spoken. And step four, control of the public is achieved. And the cure to that is speaking your mind and free those around you.
Correct. And at the same time, political correctness ensures and promotes a sort of a whiny victim mentality, right? Oh, he insulted my ethnicity, my race, my gender, my height, the number of toes I have, the fact that I'm bald, you know, any of these things that you can't change, right, that then become part of the political correctness culture. The whole point of all of that, though, at a reptilian underworld, manipulating all of humanity kind of approach, is to be able to isolate this group that is, in their minds, composes about 75% of humanity at any given point. The reason they want these people isolated is that the 75% form what the reptilian overlords would call subclass, okay? And so they think of classes, which are sort of a set theory, like in the Hindu sense, where you have a rigid class hierarchy. Reptilian minds cannot help but think this way because of certain components within the reptilian mind itself. We find a lot of the reptilian mind expressed in gaming. They do this in a couple of different ways, for instance. I don't game. I don't allow the images. Won't allow the images to control my mind. I know it's all software, so there's no point. I know how software works. It's kind of boring to me. Just like I couldn't go to a casino and do slots because you're gambling against software, and I find that really funny. But in any event, the way gaming works, the very first thing they'll do, because their audience is primarily male, they're trying to engineer this particular male mindset that is very reptilian in nature and goes to the R complex, which is the fight, flight, or frozen in fear. And what they'll do is they'll kill off a female figure in a horrific way and try and get the male user of the software to respond viscerally as the white knight in the white knight syndrome. And that brings up a particular level of emotional response. It gets endorphins kicking in the brain. It starts altering the brain chemistry. And then they've got you. And from that point on, they guide you through this whole structure so that at the end you come on out and basically you're self-programming by the number of times you repeat these sequences in these games. Now, is this a good thing or a bad thing that they're training all of these legions and legions of millennials in repetitious acts of violence and killing and so on. It may be that there is an actual good, valid point for this. One could hypothesize that the many internet nutters who claim in one form or another contact with space aliens, some of them might be correct. Some of them further might be correct that there's some nasty space aliens headed our way, and we need to have part of this millennial generation ready in about 15 years to become just absolutely blood-lusting, killing maniacs at a command of a switch that's been built into their brains by all the gaming. So applying a good or a bad context to this is neither here nor there, but it is noticeable. You can see that it's being done. You can see it's being done to a certain segment of the population. They deliberately do things that exclude the elite. You'll find, for instance, that most of those people that come from an elite background are not gamers. A telling component of this would be an analog to an old story about one of the alcohol barons here in the United States. Prior to the banning of it in the Depression era or shortly thereafter. I'm uncertain of the time frame, but he reputedly told he ran a bunch of distilleries, came across his newly reaching manhood 14 or 15 year old son drinking, beat him about the head and basically said, "Son, alcohol is for selling, not for drinking." And they don't consume the same vices that they promulgate. There's a real reason for this, and it has to do with social control and maintaining grips on power. Now that becomes extremely difficult because we have the internet, one of the greatest inventions for liberation of humanity that we've ever come across. And yet at the same time, it's of course the insidious form of, you know, Big Brother control.
Indeed.
So, you know, we're coming so to... it's like you can't grab only one half of a coin, you know.
Yeah.
If you want the heads, you've got to take the tails too.
Indeed you do. Cliff High is my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be coming to break in just a second. Bear in mind, this show is listener supported, so without your support it does not continue, and you won't be able to hear the wonderful voices of amazing people doing amazing discoveries. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the third segment already. My God, this show goes really, really fast. It really is the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. And hopefully that's because I'm having fun. So is my guest. And hence, so is the audience. And time does fly when you're having fun. Cliff, welcome back.
Thank you much.
And now we're talking about this short attention span and how the elite don't indulge in the things that they promote. And this is actually true in a lot of different contexts. For example, the British royal family promotes the use of genetically modified organisms, and yet only eat organic food. And in fact, have their own organic farm so they can control the growing process.
it's everywhere. Look at the irony of life being presented to us all around us. If you look at the British royal family, they're intensely promoting property ownership in England, intensely promoting through the banks that they own the idea of the property ladder as a way to escape out of the lower classes you've been born into and join the elites, et cetera, et cetera. And yet 70%+ of all of the property is never for sale in England because it's owned by the royalty. So you've got everybody else. You've got all this. Oh, that's why England is one of the most crowded places on the planet. I was just, in terms of actual physical number of square yards you can occupy in meaningful space. I tell you, I worked for a while as a software engineer, and I consulted to GEC, Marconi, and British Airlines. And as a result of that, working on this particular project, I got to know a lot of the software coders from their region in London and in around Heathrow and so forth. And they would come on over here to the Northwest for meetings and this kind of thing with the company I was a subcontractor to. And these were very interesting fellows. A couple of them are really soccer hooligans. This is a shock to me. At that time, I was in my 40s. I was kind of old for the software business. I got into it very late, but I was good, so they sort of tolerated me. All the kids. Because usually I was working in crews where I was by far the oldest fellow, and the age gap might have been as many as 15 years. But in any event, a lot of these soccer hooligan guys were also very good coders and had come up from the firmware side of things. And so they didn't know the ins and outs of software, but one of the things that was quite striking when they came on over was their demeanor, even to themselves, changed. The Northwest is a very open place. We've got big trees, big blue skies, water everywhere. It's crowded here. We got a lot of people. But nonetheless, you know, if you want to, you can get away and not see people for days. You could walk Hurricane Ridge at a particular time of the year and maybe walk for, if you did it just right and slow, maybe for 2 weeks and not see another human. You'd get these British guys on over, and you'd see them breathe in the air, and then they'd say, whoa, and all that. You could just see the tension coming out of them. And one of them was enough self-aware that he commented on it when we were at dinner once about how he was so relaxed over here, and it was that even though there was people everywhere, there was the freedom of being able to get out. And he was just astounded that he was over. I was taking him in a drive from point A to point B for the job for a meeting. He pointed at this group of hills that was up in the area where they were doing some clear cutting, and I was just, you know, bitching and moaning at it. I hated to see clear cutting, but we're a timber harvesting, you know, community state, and you know, it has to go on. But in any event, he was asking about it, and I said, oh yeah, they're probably going to turn it into, you know, a housing complex or something. He said, you mean somebody could go buy that land? It was just like the concept was just so foreign to him, because you could really, and I said, yeah, it'd be kind of a pain. You'd probably have to find a lawyer to, you know, throw an offer at it. But sure, you know, some of these timber companies be quite happy to sell you the land they've harvested. But the idea of land for sale, and in our state, we're heavily owned by the federal government, maybe as much as 60% of the Olympic Peninsula, maybe even higher, very large region of our state, is owned by the federal government, restricted to, you know, being park access, which they control, et cetera, et cetera. Or they claim to own it. That's a different issue. But these guys from Britain were responding to the fact that they live in a country where there's this intense pressure to join the appropriate activities of your class, maintain that, and if you're really a class climber, hey, here's your way out, the property ladder. But it's restricted to this little tiny area, and it gets worse every year. So the irony of that, you know, promoting all this stuff, yet restricting it to the dregs.
Well, when you're telling me about that guy who's like, wow, I feel so free. It's like a rat in a maze being suddenly jumped into a field, and it's just like, there you go, roam, boy. And it's like, wow.
Exactly. And I saw that in others that came on over. They had that same reaction, but they really weren't self-aware enough to be able to pick it up on them, why this was occurring, and to comment on it. This fellow was self-examining, and he said, you know, talked about it, about how amazed it was. A couple of years later, he immigrated to Canada, he and his wife.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but he had to get out for other reasons. You know, the job market was souring and all of this sort of thing, too. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. The cultural, okay. Okay. If we go way back to the beginning, and you look at the reality in terms of how things are formed, you can see why I've moved over time and into language and become very interested in it. And that's because it's perhaps it's the second largest key form of expression we have outside of our eyes. Of our senses, we find that more of our brain is devoted to sucking in information out of our nose than our taste buds, and more out of our ears than our eyes. Although the balance there is a little complex to say it's that simple. But nonetheless, if you look at reality in a particular way, you see, for instance, that we can't see atoms or molecules. If you keep looking and keep looking and keep looking, and you get into the mindset that there must be a solidness, a hardness, at some point that is indivisible, the indivisible unit, for instance, the idea of an electron or something, a subatomic particle, then you get into CERN and all these guys, all the scientists and the big particle colliders and so on. But they're chasing their own minds, in a sense. There will always be particles for them to look at that are smaller than the ones they're looking at now, and they will always be able to devise further machines to look even smaller. Mm. And none of it's meaningful. It's because it's all energy. And see, this is why language is key, and this is why language can be very prescient and express the future, is because we are basically energy beings. We exist in a a continual pulsing state that is happening at 22 trillion times a second, and yet we can only perceive reality at 40 frames per second. So most of it appears to be solid to us because we can't see it pulsing, and we can't get into that void that exists between the pulse. But if I'm correct in terms of how we want to think about this, which I believe I am on this, then if we start examining everything as being energy and all expressions in reality that meet our consciousness as being basically being energy being interpreted by these subsystems, which are our senses, then your mind and my mind are communicating by the vibratory alteration and modulation, frequency and amplitude, of vibrations in order to send messages back and forth to each other's mind. And yet they say telepathy doesn't exist.
Well, see, this is the great failure of modern medicine, is they think the human body is basically born and derived and all its processes are run by chemical reactions. And it's not true. We're electrical. There's a whole lot of other things going on.
Yeah, but that also gets back to that control issue. You've hit on another key thing. In the 1920s in the United States, there were five forms of medicine that were actively being pursued, and this exactly existed since the 1830s. There was this huge health and wellness movement that came through in the late 1820s, and lasted until the Civil War, and then picked up again in the 1870s and lasted until about the 1890s, when there was an economic crash here in the United States as these banks that were known as the Louisiana Trusts went bust. They did the same thing the Federal Reserve is doing. They printed too much money, created hyperinflation, crashed, and at that time they created a depression which curtailed this naturally occurring health movement. Out of the 1800s grew these five forms of medicine, codified forms of medicine. And these included allopathy, naturopathy, homeopathy, osteopathy, and what they called psychic studies. All of those were thriving forms of medicine throughout the United States and North America and most of the world. And then in the 1920s, this fellow came along at a convenient time by the name of Shlomo. And Shlomo was a cocaine addict and a morphine addict and a tobacco addict. He smoked cigars as many as 30 a day.
Quite ironic, because those are stimulants, so he wouldn't have been going in Shlomo, would he?
No, he certainly would not. And we know this guy by the name of Freud. Okay, his real name is Sigismund Shlomo Freud, but we know him as Sigmund Freud. And at the same time that he came around, there was this institute called the Tavistock Institute, which came out of the royalty again, out of Britain. And Tavistock Institute, and in their early nascent period, started doing things. They created the American Medical Association. And the American Medical Association was a political body that started instituting a certain form of political correctness, to where the only form of medicine allowed was this stuff called allopathy. And allopathy denies at its core that your body has any ability to heal itself. It denies, for instance, I've actually talked to allopathic surgeons online, on shows where they call in, and an allopathic surgeon to me, a bone surgeon, says, "Oh, you're wrong. The molecules in bones never, ever, ever change." And I said, "Dude, then how do you grow?"
Well, Cliff, you hold that right there. We'll come back and we'll talk about the allopathic medicine. I want to mention the Flexner Report, and I also have a joke about the Large Hadron Collider, and it's going to be fun. It really, really is. Hour number two coming up in just a few moments, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Finney Eastwood Show, live from New Zealand, live from the future. My very special guest is Cliff High, and we were talking about allopathic medicine, and beforehand, the Large Hadron Collider, and I got a joke about that. So everybody should be aware now about the Large Hadron Collider, $8 billion, four countries, and a whole bunch of scientists involved in everything, and they're like, well, you know what we want to do? We want to prove that the universe was created in a Big Bang, and we want to figure out how that happened. Who promoted the Big Bang ideology in the first place? Well, I believe it was the Catholic Church, who believed an all-powerful being created everything in a Big Bang anyway. And so they're like, okay, well, what's the possible consequences of this? And they go, well, we might actually create a black hole and kill everybody on Earth. So they're like, bugger it, let's go ahead. And so they smash these two particles together. The idea is to find out what kind of matter the universe originally started with. And so they crash these two particles together at near light speed. They explode and they do create a new kind of matter that disappeared almost instantly and had no practical benefit. And they called it Doesn't Matter.
Hey, but look, that goes right to the heart of what we're talking about, the creative use of language, right? And what it does to the mind and how we're all energy beings, and you've wrapped it all up in one nice little joke there. Also, it points to the self-absorbed focus of the scientist looking for matter when matter does not exist at all, and so it does not matter. No, it's quite good.
And the other thing I wanted to mention was the Flexner report, and the reason why allopathic medicine became like numero uno and then basically phased everybody out. Because the Rockefeller Foundation had a whole lot of these drugs and chemicals and things like that from their old leftover oil stuff that they couldn't use in your car. So they're like, well, what should we do with all this stuff? Well, we could just tell people it's good for them and feed them this real toxic stuff. And they're like, that's a brilliant idea. But won't other doctors be really pissed off with us if we just start shoving poison down everybody's mouth? And they're like, well, yeah, they will. Okay, here's this dude named Flexner. Flexner. And he goes, yeah. And they go, this is your job, okay, bro? We're going to pay you an exorbitant amount of money. And your job is to go around every single kind of medical practice in the United States. Not practices per se, but just the schools where they're teaching everybody. So we want you to grade every school. And we want you to grade allopathic medicine as very good, and anything else, like homeopathy, naturopathy, or any other of these various eclectic sort of medical practices that have existed for a long time, as not very good. And in so doing, Rockefellers now control the medical industry and have ever since.
Yeah, and it's also it's very disturbing when we look at these elements of control, because it's not conceivable to me at this point. So we have to acknowledge that whenever we say things like that, we're limiting ourselves, right? I'm saying basically I cannot conceive of these various different kinds of control not being interconnected. So I'm limiting my mind in terms of the focus I'm giving to it. However, that caveat accepted, if we look at these various different forms of control, they are all controlling it at various separate layers of our human reality, and they're all reaching towards the same form of control and the same kind of a goal. So I find basically there's a design pattern being expressed here. So for instance, they want to control, as you say, Big Pharma. They want to introduce Big Pharma and eliminate natural medicines and tonics and so forth so that they can degrade the human body. They want to control the school system so they can degrade and control the human mind. They want to control the food sources for the same reason, and they want to control the
religious,
the air. Exactly. Religions before that were easy. That's when they had easy control, and they were able to reach in and control you directly through your mind, because you willingly participate within religion in accepting constraints upon your behavior and your activity, and you willingly surrender your, to some degree, in all religions, you surrender your mental control to someone else, such that in the variance of humanity, we have some people over here like myself who are irreligious, who basically don't give a damn about religion and are anti-religion. And then you have people all the way on the other extreme that are fanatics about the religion and will cause themselves and others to die for their particular form of a delusion. And we need to note that all people are atheists. We are all atheists about gods that are not our God and that are previously dead gods. And if you really want to know what gods are, you need to look at, I think it's chapter 9 in Thinking and Destiny, where he goes into how gods exist and what they're used for and why they're necessary and so on. Now, at one point, religion was the primary form of control for the controlling elite, but mind control is self-limiting. None of these things are sustainable within the human nature. It's within the human nature to adapt, to respond to all of these various different attempts to shovel us and direct us and so on, to overcome that, to adapt to it, and then to emerge afresh from that, understand it, and go on. So commercials, for instance, in television, they had a certain impact to the point where everybody was just really in this country, in the United States, we had organizations within our various different authority structures that were all concerned about commercials and the subliminals and so on that were involved in them in the 50s and the 60s. And they had congressional hearings about them and so forth. And did it matter? No, because the population aged up with commercials, got oversaturated with them, and no longer gave them the same emotional impact within their mind and their lives as they had it initially when they encountered that media, such as it is with all media. And this is why all media over time, as with all of our technology, forces us into time slicing further and further and cramming more and more context into a smaller expression in a more dense fashion. And it puts real strain on our technology and those who would want to control us, because we can adapt faster. We're exposed to more thousands of experiences within simulations, which is what gaming is, than in you could possibly encounter in real life. So if you really wanted to train yourself, you could actually engineer games that would be truly marvelous, could teach you different languages, teach you different skills, and so on. Physical body skills could be imparted because of the way that your body would react to how your mind was being manipulated. You could, in fact, engineer games that would cause you to maintain a better posture and breathe better and have a better height-weight ratio just as a result of playing the game and its impact on your mind and how it's going to force your body to take a certain stance in the process of reacting with the software itself and the impressions it's giving you. So it could be a very powerful thing for good. And the military uses it thus to train people into simulation so that you get cellular memory. It's like the martial arts. That's all you do in martial arts is do the same moves over and 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 over. And then one day someone does something, you do that move and you don't even think about it. There's no thought involved. You're just incredibly fast because you don't have to stop and think about it. It's all cellular memory expressing itself. Now, this gets back all the way back to the language and the idea of these guys and the scientists in CERN in the collider there hunting for smaller and smaller particles. There are no particles within reality. It's all energy masquerading within our minds, being interpreted by our senses as particles and solid. So their senses have them fooled. So I can tell you right now that all of the many people involved in CERN in its design and its activation and use, all of these individuals think of themselves as their body. They do not understand that they are separate from their body. They don't understand the nature of reality or their minds or anything, because they're being directed by their minds to continually hunt for particles, which their minds will continually find smaller and smaller and smaller particles that don't really exist.
That sounds very similar to Sir Ken Ring. He was talking about university professors, and he said that they're very curious because they live in their head. They believe that their body is a form of transport for their head.
Okay, that's a little different. Okay, there's body, mind, and other aspects of mind. So a psychiatrist, for instance, is a poor, crushed being because they actually think that the mind can examine itself and cure itself and has enough capability to examine itself. It's as though you're asking an adjustable spanner, what we call a crescent wrench over here, to adjust itself. It cannot possibly do that, and the mind can't possibly do that. When you have these professors that are walking around in their heads that way, they're actually not, a lot of them are not living in their bodies. You can sort of slap them around and they sort of come to, because they've been living off in some other part of their intellectual capacity. But for instance, here's the thing. The guys at CERN think that there is a Big Bang. They believe this. They can conceive of no other possibility in universe that there is not a Big Bang. This is because of they are trapped into thinking that their body is sensory, is receiving sensory input when they feel things. And that's a different subject entirely. But because of that, they think of matter as solid. And so they're going to hunt for smaller and smaller and smaller particles of matter until they can at last say, aha, here's the little tiny brick that exists at the very bottom of all matter. And from that, all matter is created. Now, they think that this is valid information, because if you could find such a brick, you could theoretically tell this little brick of matter, oh, you're destined to become a hot dog, but I really want you to become a petunia. You know, here's some stuff, go become a petunia. And so it would become very valuable at a level of a replicator, like a Star Trek kind of thing, if you understood what was going on.
That would be like in the film Transcendence, where they use nanobots to heal and repair the entirety of the Earth, yeah?
Yeah, but see, that cannot possibly happen for a couple of different reasons. But in any event, let me continue on with the thought here about the scientists and the mind and so on. They believe that they are their bodies, and therefore there are things that are separate and outside their bodies. Tables, chairs, milk, water, oceans, stars, all of this stuff is for them separate and outside their bodies, outside them. And because everything is discriminating and separated like that, they believe that particles are separated and so on. That's why they believe in the Big Bang. The Big Bang did not exist. Reality does not come into creation that way. Reality is all of a pulse of energy. It pulsed out in the very first pulse in reality. The very first pulse that created our reality went out and came back upon itself almost instantaneously and crossed itself. As it crossed itself, it went out again and came back almost instantaneously because it travels outside of time, and did this so many times that it ended up making a knot at that particular intersection, and the very first hydrogen ion was created. That hydrogen ion, when it came into reality, came into what we call the materium, where we think there is matter. When it came in here, it came in not in the form of a big bang, but what I've termed the little bloop, because it went bloop, and it just came into reality. It brought with it space for itself and time for itself. Those are inseparable from the creation of what we think of as matter. So time and space are not separate from the individual particles that make up in their minds these particles that exist, that they think exist. Time and space are part of those individual particles. Every particle brings its space in with it and its time in with it. This can be proven with a thought experiment. These guys just don't really grasp. And that is that you can stain an object, right? Actually, let me back up a bit. So the reality is created by the energy waves crossing over until you get these intersections that create the individual, what we think of as particles or atoms. And the first one came into existence, and it's been creating, reality's been creating itself continuously ever since, and more and greater complexity over and faster through the universe as this pulse continues to intersect and intersect and intersect and intersect and intersect, layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, creating greater and greater and greater complexity towards what we don't know, nor could I care less. It's our evolution, our destiny. We'll get there at some point because we're participating in this complexity because of the fact that we're all thought, we're all energy, perceiving itself through these senses that are subsystems as real in matter. This has tricked many minds into thinking that they are actually their bodies and the matter, and that their lives are this matter. And so they go off and they hunt for things like the ability to cure the mind with the mind, and they lead to psychiatry, which is then twisted by the Tavistock Institute back to another form of mind control. Or they go off and they do things like allopathic medicine, where they say, well, you know, we're basically all machines, which could not be further from the truth because we are not matter at all. We're nothing but energy. And thus you have, quote, miracle healing, which is nothing more than energy expressing itself in a more pure, clean form. If you're an energy being and you discover, for instance, that you have a flaw of some kind, and you have the ability within your mind to understand that you're expressing yourself in that flaw, then theoretically you could change your mind and express yourself without that flaw, because you're just expressing yourself as energy. Most of us do not have the power to do that, although some humans have reportedly in the past been able to do this through the powers of their mind, and we see these people frequently at the center of the religions, which are then perverted to give other people who think of themselves as being their body, these other lesser beings without any real understanding or knowledge or power, then can pervert the religion and use it as a method for extracting control through money or whatever mechanism of the greater populace so that they don't actually have to work and think and progress in life. Makes sense?
Well, it does, and I was just thinking this: how can somebody be so smart and yet be so dumb? And I was just thinking about this: the smarter you think you are, the less likely it is that you'll realize how dumb you truly are.
I'm sorry, guy, I'm going to have to dispute that, okay? Because these people probably are smart, but they've been schooled. And there's a difference between schooling and education. In education, you observe reality and draw conclusions, and you educate yourself. You change your mind about reality. All of these guys have been schooled. Now, let me ask about our concepts of reality in terms of schooling. You've been to school.
Unfortunately.
Okay, when you were at school, How did you matriculate? How did you get out of one subset of school and pass into the next subset of school?
By going through the entire process, which never speeds up and never is enjoyable. Going through beyond, 1 year to the next year to the next year to the next year.
But the point being, beyond that, in order to go from one segment to the next, you had to pass their tests.
Exams. Yeah. I'm sorry, okay, Cliff, we're coming to break. Please just hold that thought. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Sorry, Cliff, you were talking about the difference between schooling and education and how once you go from one level to the next, you have to pass their test, their exam.
In being schooled, right. In education, you teach yourself. You come to your own conclusion, and you have the intellectual fortitude behind it, because to come to conclusions on your own like that takes a lot of thinking. You've really got to work at it. And so it becomes confidence, not arrogance. So a lot of self-educated people are thought to be arrogant, but they're really just confident because they really had to work at it. Schooled people, on the other hand, they passed from one segment of schooling to another by actually only one method, and that is parroting back specific language and ideas that they were given, not by any original thinking. In fact, original thinking does not matriculate you from one segment to another. You're, in fact, reduced to staying in that group that you were with if you have any original thinking whatsoever. Make sense? Because you can't answer the questions on their tests the way you want to. You have to give them the answers that they gave you, and they want back those answers explicitly, and any other form is not allowed to get you to the next level. So you're not required to think. In fact, you must not think in order to pass school, to be a schooled individual. So if you come to me and you say, well, I'm so-and-so, I went to this college, I've got, you know, these letters behind my name. It's like, oh, well, you poor fellow. And at your age, too, it'll take us decades to break that and get you to where you can actually think for yourself. Simply because they've been schooled out of any contact with rightness or reason. And so their assumptions are invalid, their framework is given to them and structured to control them and their thinking, and that's why we find ourselves in the mess of the world that we're in at the moment.
Well, I found an interesting expression. Some of the most degrading things you can do to somebody is to give them a grade.
Exactly. Exactly. And that, again, is also a holdover from religion. So let's examine some things that are irreligious, okay? The original universities were irreligious because these original universities practiced the Greek self-examination, observation, and forming of conclusions, the Socratic method of asking questions about, you know, hey, why the hell is that happening over there? And let's think about that and see if we can determine some conclusions about this. And so this level of thinking was promoted. Universities were, in fact, giant discussion groups where people battled out conclusions. And then over time, certain members aged into positions where they started having a structure that they thought was that they needed to get self-supporting, and were left with what we have here because it came back to that control mechanism, right? It was better to control people and get their money to, you know, serve you as the professor. And yeah, you know that this guy, other guy's a you know, full of it, but you'll go along with it because you're getting paid. You know, you go along to get along. And this is why we have peer review. Peer review is nothing more than schooling applied to supposedly new and original thought. Whoa. If it's a new and original thought, you're asking 16 other people in that magazine to vet it, to say that they think it's okay. If they think it's okay, you've got to pass the lowest level of dumbness among those 16 people in order to get it published. And this is science?
This is
exploration of new thought?
Oh, I actually was watching a debate between a pro-fluoride dentist and Dr. Paul Connett, who's a professor of toxicology and chemistry. And this guy, the dentist, was saying, there's 5,000 studies proving that fluoride is safe and effective and such and blah, blah, blah. And none of the studies that Dr. Paul Connett is citing that says that there's brain damage and such and blah, blah, blah have ever been peer-reviewed. And now I know why.
Exactly so. Exactly. And, you know, he's fighting for the establishment perspective the consumption of these chemicals is required for the human body, etc.
So when you're arguing
let's examine something here that's affecting...
One last thing I just want to say before finish up. He was arguing in favor of something that's a lie, right? And I noticed the argumentative tactics that you have to actually adopt, that you physically have to adopt if you're going to support a lie, like in an official debate of some kind. You have to, A, repeat yourself a lot, repeat lies. You have to, B, distract the audience from reality, all right, by talking about things that are completely irrelevant and then saying that they are relevant. And one of the things he was talking about was how great America is, right? Now, how great is America? And now that's fine, but what does that have to do with the toxicity of fluoride in the human body? And he was saying things like, we're the first democracy on earth. And I go, really? Have you heard of ancient Greece, bro?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And the word itself, it does not come from English. It comes from Greek. so yeah, the whole concept. No, but see, this is actually, okay, now, and then we get back into the nasty design pattern that's involved here. You keep popping up with these, okay? The guy who's doing the debating is using a series of techniques that were codified in the period of time of Rome. They were codified because people came up with a system that allowed or that encouraged those individuals that were good at debating into positions of public acclaim that ultimately led to them becoming part of the elite. And so if you got really good at debate, and debate was once again practiced and judged in certain ways that were part of the process itself, and so you were shoehorned into this whole thing, and yet it was another way to get out of your class and into the elite structure. They always leave you a way out. See, there's always this hope. That's what Hollywood is all about. Being discovered in a diner, you know, you're the poor waitress and all of a sudden you're the star. So they always leave you this the hope component. It's always there with religion. You're starving as a middle-aged or middle ages and middle-aged at 18 woman that has had three children, and you're lucky to have one of them alive, but you've got the hope that religion gives you that, you know, this is all good, and you see that this must be good because the priest is over there eating goose while you're eating dirt, and so therefore, you know, all this is good, etc. All goes back to that control, and we find the control of the system at all these various different levels, and they keep using the same patterns, these same design patterns over and over and over again, which is part of the reptilian mindset, which is actually why I believe that humanity is going to win. That's why I think we're going to win, because of a couple of things. That more humans are evolving out of that three-quarters of the population that is intensely controlled into the one-quarter of the population that has the ability to educate themselves out of the schooling that's being occupied or offered and controlled by the reptilian mind.
It's funny you
also
should...
because the reptilian mind is so hidebound, it cannot it can't deal with creativity at all. It's not a creative mind, and so we will always adapt. We'll always be one or two steps ahead of it with our adapting away from its particular control towards our self, and in a curious way, our exposure to this control is actually making us all better humans at a faster rate, because universe is that way. No growth occurs without adverse stimulation, and we've had a hell of a lot of that.
Yeah. What's this? It's just like the physics, you know, equal and opposite reactions.
Correct.
So, if that's the case, for the last couple of thousand years, give or take, humanity's been getting suppressed and like pushed down and down and down and down and down and down, and just like a spring, doesn't matter how long or how much pressure you use to push it down, as soon as you release your hand off of that spring, it goes up.
But we're not mechanical. There, see, you've fallen into their design pattern. You've fallen into the trap of allopathic thinking. Change your metaphors to the organic. Change them to biomimicry. Okay, think of, if you want to use the word spring.
Okay, what about if
we're not a medical? No, look, we're not a mechanical spring. We're a water spring. So when you push down on a water spring to stop it coming on up an artesian well, what happens? It splits. It fractures the rock, and it comes up in a thousand different places. That's us. That's
true
humanity.
That. Yep. I think about that. And in fact, this brings me to a point that I was going to make earlier, but I forgot about it. Psychopathic mindset is basically mechanical to a large degree. It's fully into the reptilian brain, And it's very, very difficult to deal with these kind of people. And statistically, I think it's between 1 and 4% of the population are psychopaths. But the problem is they tend to do very well in these control mechanisms that you were talking about earlier. They turn up in high levels of government, business, religion, and entertainment. And
everywhere. It doesn't matter. Everywhere.
Well,
and then they set up the system that promotes their own kind. Yes,
exactly. And not only that, but they set up a mechanism by which other normal people coming into that system can be converted from being themselves into being one of them.
You have to. The system becomes itself psychopathic. Therefore, if someone comes on up to you and says, "I judge you to be insane," if they do that to me, I'll say, "Well, thank you very much," because to be sane in an insane environment is no great thing. You know, I would rather be insane to this environment and not be part of it and express myself as an organic human than to fall into the trap of basically they've pushed the whole concept of allopathy into everything. I believe that they're actually attempting, that the control mechanisms are actually attempting to hack into the analog computer that is reality and change reality itself. That is to say, to change the little bloop component as it's actually being created, in the same way that they think that the physicists at CERN think that they can go on in and find that indivisible particle at the bottom of it and give it some, you know, as a stem cell, make it grow into, you know, a banana here or a Porsche over there, that kind of thing.
Well, old Indian philosopher said, he says, it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society.
Sure, Krishnamurti, exactly so. Yeah, it's no measure of health at all. And in fact, the measure of health is how much, in my mind, those people I hold in most esteem are the most unhealthy relative to the society, because they are basically at a human level, they're the antibodies, okay? These individuals that I hold in high esteem, they're out there promulgating information using our communication forms to overcome the hack that's going on to our analog computer here by getting more and more humans to join with them and understand what's going on. And so these individuals at a biomimicry level, they represent the pinnacle of a pushback of a self-actuating, self-defining, creative human being. And you find them everywhere, and there's more and more of them. And as I age, I see that there's more behind me, and that it is a process of becoming. It is not a state of being. And that therefore, because it is a process of becoming and not a state of being, it cannot be controlled. And that's where the reptilian mind fails. And so the most they can do is to shove that process this way or that way with their crude understanding of state mechanics. They're trying to create a permanent, sustainable state with them at the top, etc. And that then they keep failing and failing and failing and failing because it is not a state, it's a process. And so they're inevitably doomed to complete failure and exhaustion. But in the meantime, they again make us better, because by shoving the process back and forth, the process gradually becomes more self-examining, more aware, splits up and starts affecting its own destiny. And I think we're at that threshold now.
I was thinking about reincarnation the other day, and you know how the elites assassinate certain people, like whether that be JFK or somebody who's exposing the banking system back in the day or whatever. I was thinking, like, if that's the psychopathic mentality, and if reincarnation is real, I'm not saying I do believe that, but what happens is they try to suppress the current reality, but the thing is, it just comes back at them again later on down the track. It's sort of like perpetually paying Peter to... what's it, stealing from Peter to pay Paul kind of thing?
Sure, like the Ponzi scheme of the current currency regime on the planet that's currently dying. All of our currencies are imploding all the way up to the dollar as all these empires die, and there's something that's going to come along and replace it. I will say that incarnation, repeated incarnations, do exist. They're part of the little bloop understanding of reality. Because we are eternal beings, but our bodies are not. Our bodies are mortal, but we are immortal because we are separate from our bodies, and we're not our bodies at all. And what I was going to say was basically it's a situation for the power elite. They don't understand really the nature of humanity, and they're coming from, as I say, from the reptilian mindset. And the growth that they've pushed us into, in many ways, is their own worst enemy as we go forward. But we also have to encounter many challenges in terms of being humans at individual levels. And then the collective part of humanity, as we all start getting together and look back and say, oh, geez, what happened here? You know, how do we reconcile this? The whole idea of a, truth commissions, that kind of thing. Well, truth commissions, in my way of thinking, and government organizations are just other methods of control. But we need to address that. And so I think really the internet and these individuals that are the antibodies to the reptilian mind and the corporate establishment always will exist. They'll get even more stronger. The stronger that the humanity is pushed down, it's very much like a pressure cooker. The more pressure you put on that cooker, the more steam's got to come out. And so you create the situation that is basically your own undoing. And we see this within ourselves, but humanity to a certain extent, I think, is smart enough to recognize when you're in a hole and stop digging. And I don't think that's true of the reptilian mindset. I don't know what they're after. You know, they've been pushing us for a long time.
We're coming to a break now, Cliff, and that just reminds me of my interview with the late international forecaster Bob Chapman. I asked him, is there some kind of methodology? Is it possible to suppress and control scumbaggery and corruption and that kind of thing perpetually? And he says, no, it's a perennial problem. You always have to remain vigilant. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now the final segment. This really is the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, I must say. I hope you're all enjoying it as much as I have enjoyed bringing it to you. Cliff, are you enjoying yourself?
Oh, this is great. Yes. Yes, this is great.
Oh, damn, I'm good. Anyway, we were talking about the psychopath.
yes, you are. Truly, truly.
We were talking about the psychopathic mindset and the control grids and these things that are doing. And I really, really, that analogy about how you're pushing the spring water down, how it comes out the sides, are sort of really palpable to me, because I see, and this has probably been my experience throughout almost the entirety of my life, is that I've felt weight and suppression and things coming down on me to stop me being successful, to stop me being happy, to stop expressing my creativity. And yet, every single time this has happened, an individual has done this to me, I wind up doing something creative, growing in my own way, and doing something that I want, not out of revenge, but simply because I know that the game is rigged and I'm going to play my own little game over here.
That's a one of those design expressions again, too. You've really nailed it well this time, because the expression you're, if we accept the idea that I've got that the materium that we exist in, that we call life, is basically these little bloops of energy continually creating itself and continually expanding, then your life is continually expanding. All of our lives are continually expanding because the universe in which we live is continually expanding. But what's its point? Well, the point of universe for humans is the expression and the balancing of ourselves. That is to say, the balancing of ourselves as a thought within the materium itself. And so what you're dealing with there is the you run into someone who's going to attempt to be a constraint or a blockage or an obstacle to you, and you end up finding that your life takes a different turn, a twist, or whatever, as you encounter this particular individual or even set of circumstances. Those are naturally part of the energy cycle of life and can be easily understood. And this gets back to our future forecasting, okay? Because this is an understanding that I've come to over these past 20 plus years. I used to think that time was separate from that time was a thing in and of itself. I didn't grasp the true nature of the little bloop theory, where each atom has its own time segment and its own space segment. Now, you'd have to note that all space segments combine to form space in general, the giant space that we're in. And so space is universally aggregated from a local level. each atom joins their space to the space next to them, and then we have infinite space as all the atoms connect to each other and share their little bubble of space.
Like a DNA chain ladder or something.
Correct, correct. But any space is only local to that particular atom. The space is not separate. You can't take that space away from the atom and that kind of thing. So it's encapsulated in like a little cell, so to speak, right? Time is slightly different than that because time is a different thing within the materium. Time is just as space. It's locally... So let me phrase it another way. Space is locally effective. If you're within my local space and I slap you across the face, you'll feel it. And that's a local affectation here. But I can slap the camera and nothing happens to you because we're not in the physical space together. Time is not necessarily the same way. And in fact, I've just proved it by altering your mind, even though we're not in that same time zone. There's no interrelationship there. Time is universally applicable across universe, but locally is non-reactive, is locally non-effective. It's locally ubiquitous. So we all share the universal, what I call in perpetuo autum, which is Latin for the ever-present now. We all share that as time and so on. And space, when they aggregate each other this way, or aggregate into each other and become our space-time continuum, that's when humans start having a real problem with this. But as I was getting back to the design pattern here that you're expressing, the idea that that I used to have was that time was separate, and therefore when we got our prescient impressions, we were somehow sensing, using our sensory apparatus to get a sensation of the future heading towards us. And thus, we would then leak it into our language. And I'm not of that opinion anymore. I think that at the time that we come into our bodies, a template is created, and that this template brings into the universe for us during the time that we are in that body, all of the cuts and bruises and aches and pains and everything that you'll go through your life and accumulate. And with them are all of those events that caused them. And some sense of that event, or that's really not the wrong word, some understanding, some awareness of the event. And that those events don't impact your senses until just before that event is about to hit. So you've got in your template somewhere in your body the scar of that saw that's going to go through your leg. But you don't feel that until literally milliseconds before the saw actually goes through your leg. But you may leak that out in your language 2 weeks before by suddenly start focusing and talking about sharp objects or something like this. And that's what's going on. And we carry this with in our bodies and express this out. And it must be this way, actually, for a number of different reasons that it take too long to go into. But because that is the case, that reaffirms the idea that Vinnie Eastwood has to encounter these people as obstacles, they are actually forced through their templates to be in a position in relation to universe to be that particular focus, that pivot around which you must pivot your life. Now, if they don't do that, some other individual will present themselves to occupy that role, because there's many individuals that could occupy that role. And then you will have to decide at that moment whether to participate and learn what to do and what not to do, or to decide to put it off into another life. But ultimately, you're going to have to face that same thing over and over and over again in all these various different lives as you incarnate each and every time, because you're an eternal being, and this is the best form of expression as an eternal being. It's the best form because you would never want to be immortal. First off, all the immortals, all the claimed immortals of all of history, you'll note, are all dead, okay? Zeus and all these people that claim themselves to be immortal, Yahweh, Adonai, they all say they're immortal, they're all dead. These are all gods and stuff, they're all dead. Humanity, we don't claim to be immortal, and this is good for us because we're eternal. We keep coming back, like a bad joke, a bad pun, a bad cold, that kind of thing.
More speciality.
Exactly, we're good at it, but here's something about that. And it's good for us because imagine the situation if you were eternal, or if you were immortal. How do you freeze yourself at a particular age of time? You can't. In order to grow into immortality, you must age continually to add growth to your organism. The minute you stop that, you freeze yourself and constrain yourself to a reality that is past you. And that's what's happened to all of the gods in the past. They became immortals. They froze themselves into a subset that exists for that time because it was so cool. They got trapped in it. But time continues on.
So are you saying
continually creating themselves
that immortality is followed closely by irrelevance?
immortality is part of the psychopath mindset. It's what they seek. It freezes everything into what they think of as a perpetually sustainable system with themselves at the top. But what they don't realize is the instant you attempt to achieve that, you're deliberately freezing yourself into hell, basically, Cliff, because you're never going to grow.
That sounds exactly like the mentality of the Superman villain known as Brainiac. He goes to planets all around the universe and he actually freezes one city of a culture and then shrinks it and then keeps it in perfect stasis on his ship, and then he destroys the planet itself so that there can be no development, nothing, no expansion of knowledge, and so that he knows everything that planet contains, and only he knows that, in a pursuit to have control and dominance of all information and all life in all the universe.
And where did you get this thought? You got it from the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
That leaks out. They have to. They've got to tell you at some level what's going on for you to cooperate with it or not. And that's why they are forced to tell you ahead of time in all the crap that they do, all these false flags and everything. They've got to leak this information out because they're basically inviting cooperation in order to, the very first thing that you do as an enlightened individual, the very first terrible, hard thing that you have to face is you've got to start calling things by their true names. It's a hard, shocking thing because it leads you onto the step to internal honesty. And it's like Bruce Lee was saying, you know, the hardest thing you can possibly do is to honestly express yourself, and to be honest to yourself as you are expressing yourself is another layer upon that the awakened individual has to encounter. And so I find myself fascinated by language because my own walks on the enlightenment path that get us to where we have to talk about things in their real terms. To do otherwise is to participate in delusion. And here's the problem with that. Once trapped by delusion, once you are captivated by the object of desire, which they sell you that. They sell you desire, the way out of your misery, the way out of something, this hope I was talking about. Once you are captured by that, all you can see is that delusion. And all your senses are focused on it. And that's all you'll ever get is that sensory input leading you further and further into that delusion. And that's how psychopaths are born. Now, on the other side of that, once you've become enlightened, even a little tiny bit, you break that whole thing. You shatter it. You don't get out of it instantly. You backslide and there's all these problems. But it's broken forever, even if it's just shattered a little tiny bit. And from that point on, no matter how many times they offer you the delusion, all you can see is the mystery of the materium around you. And you'll never take the offerings of dog food when you've got the feast before you.
That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Cliff High, halfpasthuman.com is his website. Thanks very much for coming on with me today, mate.
Sure, no worries, Guy. We'll do it again soon.
Indeedy doody. And also, I wanted to, I'll talk with you after the show, but I'm thinking sometimes roundtables selected by the guests tend to be really awesome. So if you want to tell me who you'd like to come on my show with next time for a panel discussion or whatever, we'll do that. That might be very fun indeed. Oh, mate.
There we go. Yeah, that's fun. Let's mix in a lot of minds and see what kind of a stew we can create.
Exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. We'll see you again sometime.